You are listening to a special Patriotic Canada Day and Independence Day edition of the Punk News Podcast for the week of July 4, 2013. Woo! And welcome back to the Punk News Podcast, broadcasting to 183 countries and to over 800,000 listeners. And we've got a super duper special edition podcast for you today because it is July 4 and it is Canada Day. So we're here to celebrate everything that's great about our collective nations and nations all over the world, including Ghana, including India, including Bangladesh. Everybody's great. Let's just talk about independence everywhere. Punk rock is great. It's going to be a great episode. Tonight, we're going to be talking about Off's new live album. We're going to be talking about Laura Jane Grace taking her brand new album to the road, Solo Stands Against Me. We're going to be talking about Black Sabbath going on tour with Andrew WK. That's going to be a fierce one. We're going to be talking about Warped Tour again. We're going to be talking about our 1993 reviews update. We're going to be talking about Michael Graves back from the dead with his brand new solo album. We're going to be talking about Rocket from the Crypt back from the dead and their brand new album, and we're going to be talking about the Pixies if we feel like talking about it, because does anybody even care about the Pixies in 2013? And of course, this is John Gentile, features editor, and with me is the main man, the Don Mega, managing editor Adam White. Adam, how are you doing tonight?
I'm feeling very impressive because of that.
Well, you're an impressive guy, Adam. A lot of people don't know this, but Adam White is actually a pretty impressive guy. He runs his own internet-based company up in Canada. I think he was named as like one of the 30 guys under 30 or 40 guys under 40, which is pretty impressive. Isn't that right, Adam?
Yeah, but like in Niagara. So it's kind of like being the most spectacular potato in the particular bag of potatoes.
Man, don't undertalk yourself. Adam, you know what you're doing. You're a boss at the computer stuff. You're one of the bosses at Punk News. You know what you're doing, man. You're a boss. You know what I'm saying? You've got your stuff together. Am I right or am I right?
I do employ people. That makes me the boss.
Well, that makes you a boss, man. I'm telling you. But tell me, Adam, are you a real dickwad of a boss? Are you a cool? Well, here's the real question. Are you too cool of a boss? Are you just cool enough? Or are you real dick of a boss? Because sometimes bosses can be dick, which everybody knows about. But sometimes the boss is like too cool. And you're like, so what do you mean to do, boss? Like, whatever, man. Just chill out. And it's just like terrible. So how are you? How hands on them? How strict are you as a boss?
Okay, I want to think that I come up the middle on that, because I don't do the too cool thing, because that it inevitably ends up either creating problems that I have to fix myself, or costing money to the company. That so that doesn't really I'm not too cool. We're not a big enough company to be too cool. We're like, if people don't work, we don't make money, and then that kind of sucks, because then we can't pay for things like employing people. So yeah, I don't know. I think I'm somewhat up the middle there. I don't really care what people do so much as they get their shit that they've committed to being done. So, you know.
Adam, do you think giving people a leash to screw around a little bit at work actually makes them more productive or less productive?
You got to earn the leash. But let me say, you have to earn the leash, but we're a small company, so. And I'm sure like people that like have like little companies and like record labels are probably a lot like this. Bands are probably like this. If you're a small company, you can't really have people that are just kind of like there to kind of hang out and mooch around and, you know, contribute less than everyone else, because then everyone else has got to pick up the slack, because it's not like you can just say, oh, the night shift guy will do it, because no, like if you're the boss of a small company, you are the night shift guy. So you got to fucking do it then. So, you know, it's one of those, you can have rope, but you know, you got to make sure you deserve rope. And to tell the truth, if you don't deserve rope, you probably aren't really going to be employed that long, at least with me. You could like get lots of, you know, I guess not. I don't know where you can get lots of rope and have no responsibilities and suck.
A record label in the mid-90s.
Probably a record label, yeah.
And also recording the podcast with us tonight is our technological wizard, who actually wears one of those Gandalf hats while he's recording, our sound wizard, sound guy, Nariman. Nariman, hit us with some of your magic. Nariman says, we shall not pass without first playing a tune. And because it is our July 4th podcast, let's start with something patriotic. We are going to play the Star-Spangled Banner, as sung by the Melvins off the Sugar Daddy Live LP.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hail at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly
back, and we're going to get this bad boy started. And this is something I am super duper psyched about. Off the band featuring Keith Morris, Dimitri Coates, Mario Rubalcaba, and and who am I forgetting? The other guy. I feel bad. Oh, the guy from Red Cross. I forget his name, which is a shame. Oh, no. Wow, too bad I'm forgetting his name. I'll remember it by the time we're done. Anyways, they're releasing a live album, which is called Live at the 930 Club. It basically features mostly live tracks off their first album and a couple of their bonus track rarities. You can check out – they're only making 1,000 copies. They're all on vinyl, and you can – it's on – let's see here. You can check out a sound clip off at Spin, but also at the record label. The record label is Outer Battery Records. I check out the sound clip. Man, this record sounds fierce. I've seen Off live 3 times. They've been phenomenal each time, and I'm super excited about this record. Adam, have you been checking out Off?
I've been checking out Off. You know what? This is going to be a really nice sounding live record, only because Off, you know, sort of by definition, you know, sounds like shit in the first place, like in a good way. So them in a live recording situation is only going to be like that, you know, what you would have gotten on record anyways, but plus crowd energy. So that's good. I didn't mean sound like shit in a bad way. You went kind of silent there. I didn't mean to offend your, you know, they're a band that, like, you know, they pride themselves on sounding raw and sounding like the thing was recorded in a can in the 70s. Right. So it's got that whole vibe to it. So it's the kind of thing that lends itself really well to a live record.
I was a little offended, but I think you saved yourself. The other guy, Stephen Shane McDonald from Red Cross. Adam, I don't know. Have you ever seen Keith Morris live and Off, Circle Jerks, or Flag, or Black Flag back in the day?
I've seen the Circle Jerks live. I have not seen Off yet, not Black Flag. So Circle Jerks, I'm going to go on.
Yeah, did you enjoy the show?
I did. I'm trying to think when it was. I'm going to find this out with the magic of Google while we're talking.
Circle Jerks had a few mediocre records, but live they were always phenomenal. And Off is even better. I don't know. I'm amazed by Keith Morris because now he's 57, but he sounds so phenomenal. Like, his voice is just so perfect, which is amazing because he's the first to admit that he's done a lot of drugs and certain types of drugs. I don't think he's done drugs since like 96, but for a good 10 years he did a lot of drugs, and certain types of drugs really do destroy your voice. But Keith Morris sounds maybe even better than he did in 1978. He sounds so fantastic, so vitriolic. He's got that like sharp razor-hooked voice, which I absolutely love. It might be my favorite voice in punk rock, not to mention the band themselves are a crack band, especially I don't know if Dimitri Coates gets quite enough props because his riffs are pretty banging. Adam, do you think they're trying to ride off like the Flag coattails, or do you think like Keith Morris is worried that Flag's going to overshadow Off, which I think really Off is what's probably a little bit more important to Keith Morris, although he's enjoying the Flag shows. Because Keith Morris has made it clear that he really doesn't want to stay relevant and doesn't want to become like a retro kind of guy, you know?
I mean, Off is what keeps him from becoming the retro kind of guy. I mean, you could argue that the sound of Off, or just the, you know, the fact that they have these like Raymond Petterman, you know, art and all this stuff, that like, you know, there's a whole retro aspect to them. But you know what? It's new songs. That's new recorded material. I don't think anyone's going to give Keith Morris shit for sounding like Keith Morris sounds, right? So the retro part of Off is forgivable. Off is like a new vibrant thing. If he was just touring around with Flag at this point and doing that stuff, you know, I think people would still be into it and he'd still get a lot of credit, because again, I think of like any of the Black Flag people, you know, Keith is the most lovable of them. He's the least contentious of them, right? The least amount of people are going to, you know, bat their eye at him playing Black Flag songs live, I think, than anyone else at this point. I mean, Rollins won't, but you know, definitely not any of the Greg Ginn projects. But you know, I think that Off is what gives him that, I guess, that out, that like, you know what, yeah, and he can do all sorts of stuff with Flag, but off is his current ongoing artistic relevant thing. It basically, it affords him, you know, that he can do really as much Flag as he wants at this point. If this is a different situation where like all of a sudden Keith Morris, like, you know, came back from being like a used car salesman and decided to play with Black Flag again, then you know, it would be, we'd perceive it differently, but that's not the case. So yeah, I'm going to say yeah.
You brought up Rollins, and there's an interview I'm trying to pull up real quick where he talked about the Flag and Black Flag reunion, and I'm going to see if I can pull it up real quick. If not, maybe we'll come back to it later. Oh, here we go. Listen, here's what Henry Rollins said about the Black Flag reunion. This is off the LA Weekly by Ben Westhoff on June 6th. He said, "There are dueling Black Flag reunion groups touring this summer. What are your feelings about the band performing again?" Here's what he said. This is Henry Rollins speaking. "They can spend their summer vacation doing what they want, but to be pushing 60 and playing music that is 30 years old is something I wouldn't want to do this summer. That being said, I went out 10 years ago and took those songs in a brief lap around the world, but that was mission specific. I took all the money and gave it to the West Memphis three attorneys, and that is how the DNA evidence got tested to help free them. We went from LA to Tokyo, and everyone showed up. We made a whole bunch of money, and I didn't even take a dime. With these guys, Keith Morris's reunion group called Flag are going to do with the music. I hope it's good. I hope people enjoy it. I wish them all the best. But when I was invited to do this and come along, I told them I can't. I can't judge them because it goes against my beliefs and my code. For me to do it, it would not be brave. It would be resting on past laurels." And I got to say, man, I kind of think it's bullshit that Henry Rollins said that. I mean, because 10 years ago in the West Memphis 3, Keith Morris went with him. Now, I would guess that Keith Morris got paid to go on that tour, but maybe he didn't. But Keith Morris was definitely a big draw for that thing. And so in some respects, Keith Morris did Henry Rollins a favor, saying, "Yeah, Henry, I'll help you in this thing that you want to do." And now Henry Rollins is like turning around and saying, "Well, I think it's bullshit that they're playing Black Flag tunes, even though I did them 10 years ago, only because I did it to help someone else out." I mean, I just think that's whack.
I get that. I can see where Hank's coming from, only because part of his whole persona here is that he's one of these guys that is kind of restless with the things that he's done. And I mean, almost in the same, I mean, it's almost similar to I guess the Off situation, that like this, that his bid for artistic relevancy isn't to, you know, isn't to start a band that's, you know, that's relevant while playing Black Flag songs. His bid for artistic relevancy is to not do this stuff at all and do whatever the hell else he wants, because again, I mean, that in Rollins' own little universe is like the authentic way for him to go about it. So I don't want to fault him on doing that. I don't think he was being remarkably caustic or anything in that statement. Like, you know, he wasn't going to do it. He admitted that he's done it before. I don't know. He's not filing lawsuits or anything. So I don't know. I'm willing to give him a pass and just say that, you know what, I feel like he's happy just to, like, you know, let all the other Black Flag personalities kind of go do their thing at this point, and he doesn't need to, you know, barge in there and make it about him.
I don't know. I think he's being kind of whack. Like, he's talking about how Keith Morris is friend in the past. And he goes out and says, "For me to do it, it would not be brave. It would be resting on past laurels," suggesting that's what the other guys are doing. You know, I mean, if it was your friend, you wouldn't say, yeah, it's not my thing, but I wish him the best, and he would end it at that. He seemed to dig in an extra foot and a half, which I think is kind of lame. To really know, we'd have to sit down and talk with him, but he's so reticent on talking about these things, so this is all we have to go off of. And I got to say, I was kind of disappointed in Henry. Maybe I'm interpreting it wrong, but if it was my friend that was doing something like that, I would say, it's not my thing, but I think it's going to be awesome because he's a great singer, you know, so.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, on the other hand, Keith Morris is sort of like your puppy, and you didn't want anyone.
You mean John Gentile's puppy?
John Gentile's puppy, right?
You know, so, I mean, honestly, that's true.
Anytime, you love that dog.
Yeah. Anytime anybody attacks Keith Morris, short of him like raping somebody or like being racist, I'll defend Keith Morris. That's the truth.
So let's talk about this though, since we're talking about live records here. What's a good live record, John Gentile?
Oh, you know, people hate on live records, but I love live records. I love them. There's so many great live records. First of all, there's Get Your Ya-Ya's out by the Rolling Stones live in 1969. There's probably the greatest live record of all time, Rolling Stones live in Texas, 1978. There's, let's see, what else is there? There's Circle Jerks live, which is really good. There's Misfits cuts, the Misfits live record from like 1982, I think. But, you know, I was thinking about these earlier. Frank Zappa's got a million great live records. Actually, I think the best Frank Zappa live record, if you can't do that live on stage, Volume 1, where he does the entire You Can't Eat the Don't Eat the Yellow Snow suite, which is like 25 minutes long. Also, there's the Frank Zappa record, The Best Band You Never Heard in Your Life, where they do an awesome version of Stairway to Heaven. They do a Johnny Cash cover. It is a phenomenal, phenomenal live record. Go ahead, Adam.
No, I was going to say, on the one hand, I'm sort of surprised that you didn't go live at Leeds. The other hand,
I never strike
me as a Who fan.
I've been trying to get into the Who for the past year. It's just not hitting me. It just seems not quite rocking enough for me, you know?
Yeah, I get what you mean. Now, okay, so now you listed a lot of classic kind of live records there.
Oh,
so here's the question. Modern live records that are worth their shit.
World Inferno Friendship Society live at North 6.
Cool.
That one, I actually just saw World Inferno. Actually, this is crazy. We're going off topic here, but who cares? I saw World Inferno live last Friday, was it? At this place called the Stanhope House in Stanhope, New Jersey, in the middle of nowhere. Adam, do you know a lot about the geography of New Jersey?
Oh, I got like a tattoo of it.
Oh, like people don't realize is people think of the Jersey Shore, but really most of New Jersey is almost like forest. It's like very spread out, a lot of trees, a lot of plains and stuff. And there's a place called the Stanhope House out in New Jersey. And the house itself is over 220 years old and it's still standing. And B.B. King was there and John Lee Hooker was there. All these blues legends were there. And World Inferno played there. Probably about 200 people were there. It was a phenomenal, phenomenal live show. If you get a chance, people, go see World Inferno live. They are great. But also, there's two great live hip-hop records. Generally, hip-hop is thought of being kind of weak live. Which actually is kind of true. I've been doing my fair share of hip-hop shows, and a lot of these hip-hop guys do kind of phone it in. But BDP Live Hardcore Worldwide is one of the best hip-hop live records of all time, one of the best live records of all time. It's KRS-One just doing fast, furious versions of BDP songs, but also the Public Enemy Live World Tour record from like 2008 is phenomenal because Public Enemy is phenomenal live. But I'm trying to think of like even newer bands that have great live records. So, Adam, what live records do you like?
You know, I mean, live records, I mean, in terms of classic live.
Oh, I got to interrupt you one more time. Melvin's live. Check this out.
Yeah.
You can buy, it's called the Melvin's Residency box set. And originally, they made it only on vinyl records. And it was like $500 for like 8 vinyl records. But they made a download for $5. For $5, you can get 6 Melvin's live albums from 2010. They are phenomenal. They do Lysol live. They do Houdini live. They do Colossus of Destiny live. They do Stoner Witch live. They do Bullhead live. And it just goes – like Melvin's are one of the greatest live bands because you never know what they're going to do live. They don't just do like jukebox versions. They do like whacked out versions of their music. And for $5, you get like 70 tracks or something. And it is so great. I mean it might be their best release. So that's a great modern live record.
All right, so I mean, on the classic end of things, I'm a Live at Leeds fan. The double set that they released of that back when you know they were doing those deluxe CDs where they were in like a little plastic slipcase things, and there was like 19 CDs in those cases that when basically they're trying to make money by reissuing everything.
I love that.
Yeah, well, the one of that for Live at Leeds is really good. So there's, you know, there's the full kind of live set on there, but then there's the at that concert they played Tommy in its entirety as well. So there's like the full Tommy is on the second CD. So yeah, so that's cool. It's genuinely. Yeah, it's nice to record it. It sounds awesome. It's good. So Live at Leeds, yeah. Punk Era 2. First, there's a it's really a soundtrack to a British documentary on the English two-tone movement called
Adam, I
Dance Craze.
I saw that. I bought that record like a week ago. I saw it at a punk rock flea market, and I got it.
Yeah, well, that's where I got mine. It's at a flea market. So yeah, Dance Craze is awesome. It's like there's stuff from like Bad Manners, the Specials. I don't know if they were the Specials, AKA at the time, or this is the Specials. They're probably the Specials. Madness, the Selector, the Beats on there, or the English Beat to Americans. But anyways, it's all like live music that was recorded at these concerts for that documentary, which I don't even think I've seen, but. It all sounds great, and to me, a lot of that live stuff sounds a lot better than the recorded material that came out, especially for bands that started the trend a little bit out of ska and a little bit into new wave, because, I don't know, a lot of new wave stuff sounds really artificial to me. So there are songs like, say, Mirror in the Bathroom by the English Beat that are on there that, in real life, I was to hear it on the radio, I'd just be like, 80s. But on Dance Craze, I really like it. It sounds, it's got some energy to it. The tempo's a little bit sped up because it's played live in that kind of environment. So I really like Dance Craze. In terms of a historical artifact, there is I don't know why these are all film documentaries. There is another soundtrack to a film that was a crazy little short film that was recorded in Toronto in 1978 called The Last Pogo. And this was a concert that was kind of billed as the last punk rock concert in Toronto. Which is kind of funny because this is like 1978. And basically the soundtrack to it, which I also have on vinyl that I bought. I bought it in Guelph, Ontario or something like that. Anyways, it's a bunch of these like Canadian punk bands from the late 70s that probably have no relevance to anyone who even listens to this show. The only one that you may have heard of is a band called Teenage Head that's on there. But there's, a bunch of other bands that are from that era that I'm not sure a lot of you guys will have heard of. Bands like the Vile Tones, the Cardboard Brains, the Scenics, really esoteric Canadian stuff. I don't think if you were around at that era or a Canadian music wonk that you would know these days, but it's really one of the only artifacts of that era that I have. So I really like that. In terms of modern stuff, the one that I really like, and I don't really feel that this record ever got its due, was a live Black Lips record that Vice released in 2007 called Los Valentín de Mundo Nuevo. And I'm sorry, I can't pronounce Spanish words at all. But it was a live album that they put out. It was a live show that was purportedly recorded in Tijuana, Mexico. According to Wikipedia, that claim has actually been called into question. But anyways, I don't know. There's a lot of craziness from the crowd that's going on in the background. And if it's artificial, I don't know, it still kind of sounds awesome. The whole thing sounds like a riot. And the nice thing is that it's a lot of songs that appeared on the band's previous stuff that had come out on In the Red, but more importantly on Bomp Records, which is a big historic garage label that I don't know if you've had too much to do with, John, but the Bomp stuff that they released, specifically a 2004 LP called We Did Not Know the Forest Spirit Made the Flowers Grow. They're kind of hippies, I guess. But the songs on that record are awesome, but they really sound like shit. Like, not in like the good way that I said Keith Morris and Off kind of sound like shit. Like, in the bad way. Like, this was recorded with an old transistor radio as the only equipment or something. Like, it sounds horrible. So having cool live versions of those songs are great, and the whole thing is really fun. Again, I don't know if this is the first time I've encountered like questions to its validity, but I guess that's there. But I really like that record. So yeah, it actually, of anything of the Black Lips, and I like the Black Lips, that's really one of my favorite things that they put out. So people should listen to that.
Not to dwell on this too much, but I forgot about two very important punk rock live records that every punk should own in their collection. Ramones, It's Alive, which you could even say is the best Ramones record there is. I don't know if I would say that, but you can make a good argument for it. But also The Decline of Western Civilization soundtrack, part one. It's got some very rare live Black Flag songs with Ron Riez on vocals. It's got some awesome Bags tune. It's got a cool Germs tune. It's got an awesome Fear tune. So those are all great records. And actually, I just looked up some of the, quote, 100 greatest live records of all time, and I'm just going to name someone that everyone should have in their collection. James Brown live at the Apollo in 1962, phenomenal. Johnny Clash live at San Quentin and Folsom, phenomenal. Sinatra, the main event, live, phenomenal. Bob Dylan, the Rolling Thunder Review, live in 76. That's awesome because it's Bob Dylan and Mick Ronson of David Bowie on guitar. That is a great live record. MC5's first record is phenomenal. Let's see what else we got here real quick. Not to dwell too much on this, but there are so many great live records. And for some reason, live records are – oh, crap. David Bowie's has a deluxe edition of Station to Station where he does all Station to Station live plus a lot of his older songs in his Thin White Duke persona. That's one of the greatest live records of all time, which is really, really a cool record. It's like Bowie at his most scariest, which is really awesome.
You know what I think burned me on live records a lot was kind of growing up in the kind of like the Epiphat skate punk era. Because as much as I love a lot of those bands, and I still do, I cannot think of a live record from that ilk that I give a shit about or want to hear ever again.
Yeah, I think you're right. But speaking about live things that people want to go see, I really want to go see this upcoming tour, but actually I'll be in California when it's in PA. Laura Jane Grace is just doing 5 quick shows where she's going to be playing Transgender Dysphoria Blues. This will be people's first chance to hear these long-awaited and much-anticipated tracks. It starts on August 10th in Philadelphia, ends August 16th in New York. There's only a show in PA, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New York, and New York, Brooklyn, and then New York City. And I got to say, man, I really like to go see these shows just because I feel as though it's almost a cultural event. Do you agree, Adam? Is this something more than just live tracks?
I think the fact that she's going out and playing these things solo and not doing it as an against me gig, which she would have absolutely every right to do, being, you know, think of how much in like Against Me's early days that, you know, she was, you know, it was her and the drummer at the time, right? So it was, she would have every, you know, that name, you know, she owns that name. She could go out and play these as Against Me if even it was like her and a drum machine, and no one would question that. I don't know, someone would question it, but I wouldn't personally question the legitimacy of it, right? Because as an artistic expression, you know, Laura Jane is against me is Laura Jane to me, so she could do that, but she's not. And I think that means that you may get something that's a little bit, maybe a little bit quieter, maybe a little bit more personal, maybe a little bit more raw. So I think, yeah, these are this would be a very interesting show to see.
Do you think it's more than just her debuting new tracks? Do you is this the very first record where a transgender person is debuting songs about being transgender for the first time ever? I think it might be.
I have no way to know that.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. There's definitely been, you know, other examples of artists that have had that have come out as transgender, but is this the first one where it is so central to the artistic expression / a band with this profile?
Well, exactly.
You know, that I would say, you know, probably, but I don't want to slight anyone by not having the example in hand because, you know, I probably don't.
I think, and I might be overstating its importance because it is overstate things' importance when you're in the middle of them, but I think this really will be a lot of people's first real confrontation or experience of a person that used to be one gender and is now another, or used to present themselves as one gender, is now presenting themselves as another gender, their first real interaction with that. So I think punk rock-wise, this is pretty important. Anthony and the Johnsons comes to mind, but Anthony and the Johnsons was presenting as a female on the first record, whereas Laura Jane Grace used to be Tom Gable, who no one really thought of as that feminine necessarily fan-wise, and now is presenting herself as a female. So I think it's going to be something real interesting, and I'm excited to see what happens. So we'll see.
Yeah, I wish I could be at one of these shows.
Yeah, I do too, man. I'm bummed out that I'm missing it, I'll tell you.
Oh, I don't know. We'll have to wait.
And then on other exciting tours, Black Sabbath is touring with Andrew WK. And I have to say, it's an inspired pairing, but I think it works pretty well. It's a fairly extensive tour. Starts July 25 in Texas and runs through September 3rd, all the way out in California. They're hitting all the major cities. There's two questions. Are the Black Sabbath fans going to be receptive to Andrew WK? I think they probably will be. Second question is it Black Sabbath without Bill Ward?
I don't know if they will be receptive to Andrew WK, but on the other hand, I don't necessarily think that. I'm going to insult a whole waft of people here, but like, I don't know. Are the kind of people that are going out to Black Sabbath shows in this day and age, do they really care what else is going on? I mean, like, they could bring out like some mimes or something, or just like have a guy come out and sweep the stage and whatever. They're there to see Sabbath, right? They're not really there to, I don't know, to take in a full night of performances or something like that. Are they?
Yeah, honestly, you're kind of right. In some ways, the heavy metal community is extremely progressive and extremely accepting of other things. And in other ways, you know, the heavy metal crowd, they just want that one band, and they want that one band to play all the hits and nothing else but the hits.
See, but I'm not even thinking about like the metal community so much as that, like, because, you know, I'm sure that at a smaller show, the metal community would be open to all kinds of crazy shit that's going on before whoever they're there to see. But I mean, you want to talk about nostalgia. Sabbath isn't out there. Yeah, I know that they have a new album and all that, but they're not there because they're there to make new friends, right? They're there to play. They're there essentially to do the jukebox set.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I saw Sabbath. One of the most fun cons I ever saw was Slayer, Judas Priest, and Sabbath. I think that was an Ozfest, and that was a great tour. And that was kind of like the last tour where Ozzy still had his good voice. I've heard that Ozzy's voice is whack, but after listening to that last studio record, he sounded pretty good. So I don't know, man. I might go to this. I'm not sure. I kind of have a grudge against Black Sabbath because they did muscle out Bill Ward. I think it's the lamest thing. I think it's really lame how they muscled out Bill Ward. In case the Punk News listeners don't know, Bill Ward is Black Sabbath's original drummer. He was their drummer for the first 11 years and their first 9 albums, I think. He was scheduled to be a drummer on the new album and on the new tour, but then basically what happens is Ozzy Osbourne didn't want to pay him enough money, and so they basically muscled him out of the band and said, well, you can't join us unless you drum for free, which I think is really lame. I mean, obviously he's not asking for more than a quarter, so Ozzy's being unreasonable. And I'm going to kind of demarcate this real quick. And a lot of people say, isn't Sharon Osbourne evil? Isn't Sharon Osbourne this? Isn't Sharon Osbourne that? Because she's so vicious. I think Sharon Osbourne is vicious. But the people giving hate towards Sharon Osbourne and not toward Ozzy, I actually think is lame and almost sexist. And here's why. Sharon Osbourne is not Black Sabbath. Sharon Osbourne is Ozzy Osbourne's manager. Therefore, it's Sharon Osbourne's job to get her client the best deal that she can get, which is what she does. Whereas Ozzy Osbourne is in Black Sabbath. Hypothetically, Black Sabbath are his friends, or at least people that he has a certain bond with. The mere fact that he lets his manager muscle out people and bully people around and steal the trademark from Tony Iommi isn't Sharon Osbourne being mean. She's just doing her job. It's Ozzy Osbourne being spineless and backstabbing his friends. So all the Sharon Osbourne hate I think is a little undeserved, and I think Ozzy is deserving a little bit more of the hate for being such a vicious businessman. And people are like, well, Ozzy can't, quote, control Sharon Osbourne. Well, not that spouses control each other, but it's also a business relationship. So if you say to your agent, I don't want you to sue my guitarist, I don't want you to muscle out my drummer or I'll fire you, then the agent say, okay, I won't do it. And Ozzy Osbourne doesn't say those simple words. So honestly, I think it's lame that Ozzy does that.
Cool. I know cool was not like cool that he's doing.
Cool.
It was like
cool story,
cool. That
bro.
Was a John Gentile rant about Black Sabbath.
No, cool story, bro.
Yeah, cool story, bro. No, but there's one more thing here that we have to touch on here. Andrew WK is not going to be playing live.
Oh, what's he doing?
I found this on a much more reputable news site than ours. He will be doing DJ sets of, quote, a rabble-rousing selection of classic riffs, heavy jams, and crowd-pleasing favorites spanning every era of hard rock and metal. End quote.
That's weak. That's weak.
Yeah. Want to play a song?
Yeah, let's have a jam.
All right. So you played what?
I played the Melvins earlier.
You played the Melvins earlier playing, was it Star Spangled Banner or America the Beautiful or?
Star Spangled Banner, which is adapted from a much earlier, like the actual music to Star Spangled Banner is like ancient music. Like it goes back to like 100 AD, I mean 1000 AD. Nobody knows where it comes from.
Handed down by God. So, this is also, by the time this is posted, it'll probably be the 4th of July, right? Yeah, probably will. Probably post it that day. Look at that. All right, Americans, this is for you. I was trying to find something really super Canadian to play because we just had Canada Day up here, which is on the 1st of July. Although we call it July 1st, although we don't call it anything, we call it Canada Day. I didn't really have anything super Canadian that I had the rights to play on this, except for this. And this is really one of the most important songs in the Canadian songbook. This is up there with, you know, up there with Neil Young, up there with Ian and Sylvia, up there with the band, up there with Gordon Lightfoot and Stompin' Tom. This is important stuff here. This is "I Got a Disease, I'm Addicted to Cheese" by The Evaporators off their album Ripple Rock that came out on Mint Records and Alternative Tentacles back in 2004. This is some prime Canadian shit. Here you go.
Back on the second part of the Punk News Podcast. The first part was freewheeling, dealing. We were just talking, and honestly, we're probably going to keep that up because, it's July 4th, Canada Day. And actually, Adam, I mean, what does Canada Day signify? Does it commemorate any one particular day?
we're celebrating, like, the Confederation of the country, so, you know, when a bunch of drunk men got on a boat and collectively signed a piece of paper that created Canada in an act that you guys had to have a bloody revolution to achieve.
That's how we roll, baby. If you can't get what you want, you have to stand up for your rights. Party for your right to fight, that's what I say. Or fight for your right to party. Speaking of fighting for your right to party, this segue makes no sense at all. However, we recently had a fairly popular article over at Punk News. As I'm sure you listeners know, over Punk News, we usually run either 10 or 20 reviews a week. Mostly it's new records. Every once in a while we'll throw in an old record. But because it's 2013, we decided to review a bunch of 20-year-old records. So we reviewed a whole bunch of records from 1993. We covered Fugazi, In on the Kill Taker, we covered Quicksand, Slip, Screeching Weasel's Anthem for a New Tomorrow, Tool's Undertow, The Melvins, Houdini, Propagandi's How to Clean Everything, and Carcass's Heartwork and a couple of other records. It was real popular with the readers. Adam, 1993, does that have a special place in your heart? Do any of those records have a special place in your heart?
I want to say the records from that era that I really like, I probably found in retrospect, because if I do the math, and I'm not a mathematician, but if I do the math, I think I was 11 in 1993. So if I think back to 1993, this is what was important to me. In 1993, you had Adventures of Superman number 500, which is when Reign of the Superman started. You had Maximum Carnage going on at Marvel.
Yes!
You had the Infinity Crusade happening at Marvel. You had Batman 500, which was Nightfall. You had, you had Wolverine 75, which was when Magneto pulled all of his adamantium off of his bones as part of the Fatal Attractions event. So you had all of these horrible cardstock-covered foil hologram 90s comics happening that were really dumb when you look at them now, but when I was 11 was awesome.
I thought Nightfall was pretty cool.
I'm sure all of it is pretty dumb at this point, but at the time that's what I was into. So, you know, there's definitely stuff that I like from 1993, but I'm not going to lie and say that I was listening to it then. You know, how to clean everything from Propagandi at that time. Rancid had their first record came out, and then the Radio EP on Fat, which was the first thing they recorded with Lars Fredriksson, came out then. And Recipe for Hate on over on Epitaph for Bad Religion came out. So, you know, there's lots of stuff that, I listened to probably a few years after that when I started getting into music, but the real 1993 for me was comic books.
Yeah, honestly, in 1993, I think I had four albums. The first album I got was the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle Pizza Hut Party cassette, and it had the Ninja Turtles rapping about being Ninja Turtles.
The second one I got
was Simpsons Sing the Blues, which I think is actually still kind of a cool record. The third I got was Metallica's Ride the Lightning, but not because I was cool, just because I liked the cover. And I don't know, honestly, my parents know nothing about music, so they just let me get it. And I didn't get back into Metallica probably for like 10 years after that. But I actually listened to that cassette quite a bit, and actually it kind of scared me when I was 10, particularly the instrumental Call of Cthulhu, which is a really creepy instrumental. And the fourth record I got, fourth cassette I got was the Rolling Stones Voodoo Lounge in 94, which is not one of their better albums, but I loved back in the day, and I listened to it over and over and over. So I wasn't hip to any of this. Honestly, I didn't get hip to any of this music till like, I'm still not hip to most of this music. but what surprised me is about prop. This is very interesting. 5 years ago, most of the readers would have said that Propagandi's How to Clean Everything is by far Propagandi's best record and one of the best records put out. Now, a lot of the punk news readers say Propagandi's How to Clean Everything is sort of embarrassing for its Epiphat sound, and their more heavy metal stuff is the more true version, I guess, of Propagandi. What do you think of that, Adam?
I disagree with our readers. How to Clean Everything, I mean, we're talking about it because it was a 1993 record, and that's what we're commemorating right now. So it is sort of the Propagandi record that came out during the time period that we're talking about. And that's why that's why it's in conversation. I don't really think it is as fondly remembered as we like to make it out. I think that Less Talk, More Rock, the one after that, is the one that to me was really important. And the transition between Less Talk, More Rock and, you know, Today's Empires, which, you know, in music, you know, in music time frames came out like a billion years after that, was so big that for a lot of us for a long time, you know, Less Talk was the Propagandi record. And, you know, I think that from an artistic standpoint, I guess it's such a better record than How to Clean Everything. So, you know, I think that era definitely deserves some praise. It's my favorite era of Propagandi. I think that they completely lost their heart and sense of humor when John Kay left the band. But I don't think that it's I don't know. I don't think it's something that people need to get like so passionate about. Like, I don't think that any of like the modern day propaganda stuff has been such a revelation. It's kind of been, you know, people are going to hate me for this. It's been fast and, you know, entertaining when it's on, but it's all to me been kind of boring.
I back you.
I mean, I hate to say that because there are songs on all the new propaganda records that I think are amazing songs, but I think that they're a little bit too in love with this combination of like their ideology and this kind of thrash influence that they've pulled in with some of the guys from these Winnipeg thrash bands that are in the band now. And it rips, you know, I hate using that sound like a dick. It rips, quote unquote, when it's on, but you know, I can't say that I remember, you know, 8/10 of a modern day propaganda record aside from like the quote unquote single. So I keep saying quote unquote, I'm going to just go to bed. But yeah. So I don't know how to clean everything. It was important. I don't think it was as important as Less Talk, More Rock. I don't think it needs to necessarily elicit a huge emotional reaction from anyone one way or the other, maybe compared to some other stuff that came out in 93. But, you know, we're punk news. So we're going to talk about propaganda when we have a chance. So,
yeah, a lot of the readers had a lot to say about this on Twitter, too. I got a bunch of shout outs on Twitter. Mr. Spike, who's a regular punk news reader, he goes by Spike or Mr. Spike. He said Killtaker is his favorite record from 93 because he said Killtaker because Fugazi. Also saw them that tour and have the official live series bootleg to prove it. So that would be pretty cool to see Fugazi in 93. That's kind of like the height of Fugazi, if you ask me.
Oh, Killtaker. I don't know the height. There's Fugazi records that mean so much more to me than that one.
Like what one?
I don't know. I'm weird in that like the argument is honestly my favorite Fugazi thing, but you know, I still think, you know, that 13 songs, I still think that Repeater, like those two, I know it's super cliched and everything, like those two just have more mental resonance for me than the other things. Even, and though I know it's a worse record by far, for some reason I even have more of a mind for Red Medicine than Killtaker, only because I think it's just one of those things that like when I got into Fugazi, and I was not into Fugazi in 1993, whatever order I picked up those records in and started listening to them, it for some reason, like I couldn't find Killtaker, but I found Red Medicine, probably because no one likes it. So I had heard a lot more of Red Medicine by the time I had heard Killtaker, and just it was one of those things that had sunk in more. I don't know. Music opinions are stupid, but yeah, it's an awesome record. Don't get me wrong.
Will Fugazi ever get back together?
No.
Minor Threat or Fugazi? I got to go Minor Threat just because I think it's a little bit more revolutionary and the songs are just tighter and better, frankly. People say, nah, Fugazi songs are so clever and complex, and they are, but there's something to be said for just the pure songwriting simplicity of Minor Threat. That's what I say. Kira Wisneski, who was our reviews editor, she says Janet by Janet Jackson because there are a million hits on it and that album cover. That's the famous album cover, which kind of generated a little controversy, where it's got her topless on the front and then some dude is grabbing her breast so you can't see her actual nipples, I guess. That guy is somebody famous, but I forget who it is. But Adam, are you a Janet Jackson fan? Mrs. Jackson, if you're nasty?
I don't even know what to say. No, definitely not in 1993. I was not. I don't know. I feel that the course of my life keeps taking left turns away from Janet Jackson, and Janet Jackson is always the right turn.
will there ever be a Janet Jackson comeback?
Is she gonna like play for Fugazi? Like a Sublime with Rome sort of thing.
I would go see that Janet Jackson with Fugazi. I would pay like $75 to go see that.
I don't even know where I'm going with this. What?
Here's what Brownie who goes by Diogenes 347 on and as the Punk News listeners know, Diogenes was a famous philosopher who founded the Cynic school, which is fitting for Punk News, although Brownie seems pretty cool. He says his favorite record from 93 was 36 Chambers by Wu-Tang Clan, and here's why. Wu-Tang raps better than anybody. Oh, and he also liked the No Means No record called Why Do They Call Me Mr. Happy. He says Wu-Tang raps better than anybody, and No Means No are so technical and really captured the dark mad humor that is Madness recorded. Adam, are you a Wu-Tang head? Are you down with the Clan? The C-L-A-N, not the K-A-L-A-N.
Wow, yeah, those are two different things. Say, I don't know. I couldn't name a damn part of it. I mean, I respect it only because like the music people that I know have kind of like driven that into my head over the years. But you know, I've it's not something I grew up with, so it's not something that I can really talk about.
Go ahead, Adam. I'm sorry.
No. I was gonna say, but I bet you if you actually sat down and like did the math of it, we're talking about 1993 in terms of punk rock because that's what we are. But I got a feeling that 1993 was probably far more important a hip hop year than it was, anything that was going on with guitars.
Oh, absolutely. Honestly, really, you could argue that 1993 was the most important year for your music because that's the year Chronic came out. Chronic changed hip hop unfathomably. Before the Chronic, hip-hop was pretty fast and bum, 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 bum. Chronic comes out and hip-hop got slow and kind of like easy grooving music. And it's never really come back from that. There's very few popular like banging style hip-hop. It's all been slowed down to the Chronic, you know. As for Wu-Tang, I'm not a Wu-Tang maniac, but I like Wu-Tang. Wu-Tang guys, they put out a lot of great records and a lot of whack records. But lately, the Wu-Tang guys have been on fire. Ghostface just put out 12 Ways to Die, which is a phenomenal record. It's probably one of his best after like Fish Scale. And also, there's the Man with the Iron Fist soundtrack, which is basically a Wu-Tang album. That only got like medium reviews, but that record is actually phenomenal. It's got some of the weirdest and most interesting Wu-Tang delivery styles on it. There's one song, it's like Blowing in the Wind or whatever, where I think it's RZA. Like just this really weird vocal style that he borrows from Bob Dylan, which is pretty trippy. And also, the Wu-Tang mixtapes tend to be better than their albums, honestly, especially the Ghostface Fish Scale mixtape, which is called Fish and Chips, I think. So anyway, I think we're in the middle of a Wu-Tang renaissance, to tell you the truth.
So anything else in 1993? I mean, really, for me, yeah, Reign of the Superman at that point. that's all I got.
Adam, should we shut this bad boy on down? We're talking about Warped Tour once again.
Oh, that's what the people want.
That's what the people want.
That's what people want.
So anyways, as I'm sure the Punk News listeners know, a little while ago, apparently the Warped Tour says you can't – they put a mandate out towards the bands, and the bands apparently are not allowed to say you should start a mosh or you shouldn't start a wall of death. So a lot of people said, Kevin Lyman, that's lame for you to tell the bands that they can't say that. So Kevin Lyman, the organizer of Warped Tour, here's how he responds to people saying that the bands can't say you should start a mosh. Kevin Lyman said, if you join a mosh pit, it's fine. But if the bands do it, they become responsible for all the injuries that occur. People do not take responsibility. In America, that leads to many lawsuits. Have you ever sat in on one? I have been through many. No fun and costly. Instead of waiting for bands to call for it, start one on your own and be a leader. That's what Kevin Lyman said.
So John, as representative of the U.S. legal system in its entirety, is that true?
Well here's what I'm assuming this no call for moshing thing is, and when a venue or when an area creates a dangerous situation, if someone gets injured because of that dangerous situation, then the venue or the person encouraging the dangerous situation could be sued, or the event organizer. So let's say you go see what's like a really tough band that people think are tough. Let's say you go see Mikey Erg, and Mikey Erg's like, mosh it up. I want to see you fuck each other up, and people mosh and hurt each other. Then whoever gets hurt that like wasn't moshing could sue Mikey Erg. They could sue the venue. They could sue the person. They could sue anybody, because simply going to a concert doesn't mean you're giving people a license to hurt you. So I assume by Warped Tour issuing this mandate saying bands can't say people should mosh, they're protecting themselves, because if I was a lawyer and I had a teen or a preteen go to a concert that wasn't moshing and get severely hurt by some jackass moshing, because people are jackasses and do this, then as an attorney, I would love to say, you know, this 14-year-old young lady who was minding her own business, this band, you know, Falling in Reverse, said to beat people up, and someone beat up this 14-year-old girl who was minding her own business. Certainly, the promoter and Falling in Reverse are liable for this. And I guarantee you, a jury who is not familiar with punk rock concerts would rule for me 99 out of 100 times, and I would get lots of cash, right? So the point is he's trying to stop bands from creating a situation or encouraging a situation that makes it dangerous for people watching the show. However, he does this, which doesn't make any sense. He says, if you want to start a mosh pit, you should do it. Be a leader and start your own mosh pit. So basically, he's overriding what he just said. In one part, he's saying bands shouldn't encourage people to start moshes, but now, in writing, nevertheless, not even like on stage, in actual writing, he says you should start a mosh pit if you want to start a mosh pit. Which, if I was an attorney, and I mean, obviously the promoter's got more money than the actual band. If I got a 14-year-old girl and she gets hit by some jackass who wants to be a tough guy, and this 14-year-old girl's not moshing, I would say, look, jury, the promoter of this concert told people to mosh. He said, be a leader and start your own mosh pit. And now this poor girl's hurt, and she just wanted to enjoy a concert. I mean, it doesn't seem too smart to me.
Yeah, and I guess I can see what his initial motivation would have been in doing this. And I got to imagine this is blown up more than it would have otherwise. You know, if he would have told the bands this, and the bands would have went, yeah, all right. And it never became an issue. You know, it didn't come out that, some band is being sanctioned on the Warped Tour because they encourage people to mosh, right? No one probably would have heard anything about this, and there probably still would have been moshing. I mean, there still is. And, you know, no one would have batted an eye on it. But this is one of these things, like in this social media era, where you say something that you know, sounds a little bit dumb, it's going to get amplified online and people are going to react to it. So it's...
I mean, can you imagine being like, let's say somebody gets hurt. Can you imagine being like the attorney for the defendant, and you say, and the other attorney says, I have in print the promoter of the show saying people should start moshing, an activity that we all know is dangerous and leads to injuries. And he,
oh yeah,
injured.
I mean, I'm sure that this, I gotta say that this whole thing was probably started because you know, the organizers of Warped's legal counsel said that, hey, maybe we should do this. And I'm sure that same legal counsel is kind of looking at these series of tweets and is just kind of shaking their head and going, shit. Right? That's not helping at all.
Honestly, I go by the golden rule. If you want to mosh, that's fine. It's a valid way to express yourself. Just when you're moshing, make sure you're moshing with people that want to mosh, and don't be the, quote, big tough guy that runs into people that aren't moshing, because these big tough guys that run into people that aren't moshing, they never run into the biggest guy in the room. They always run into the second smallest guy in the room. You know what I'm saying? So if you want to mosh, just be cool about it and mosh with guys that want to mosh, and don't try to show how tough you are by mosh with people that don't want to mosh, because that just shows you're not that tough.
You know what? We talked about this last week, so I don't want to reiterate points that I made too much last week, because I'm sure readers hang on everything that I say and they don't have anything that happens to them in between listening to me boringly talk about things. But man, do I hate when bands tell me to dance.
But do you love it when you start dancing, when the band doesn't tell you to dance and you're just so overcome with the rhythm?
Well, that's the thing, is that like if the band is up there and they're playing something that, you know, people are gonna dance or mosh or run around to or whatever, and people do because they're into it, then that's fantastic. But I don't know. I've very rarely been at a show these days, because I tend to see shows in very small bars, it seems. But I haven't been at a show lately where someone up on stage has just been like, you know, all right, everyone, time for the circle pit. I don't know. That's it seems so. I don't know.
Adam, what's the last show you were at where the rhythm was going to get you and it did?
Ooh, that's a good question.
The rhythm's going to get you. The rhythm's going to get you.
I keep seeing all these sad bastard alt-country people, so there's no rhythm to get me at these shows.
Check this out. I'll give you time to think. I was at World Inferno on Friday, and actually, I'm going to get a little sentimental here. It's mostly younger kids at World Inferno, and you know, World Inferno has like waltzing during their show a lot, which a lot of people have fun with. Let me tell you, and I'm going to sound creepy saying this, but I don't really mean to. If you are an awkward high school boy, you should go to a World Inferno show because there's lots of plenty awkward but perfectly nice high school girls just waiting for you to ask them to dance. Because I was people watching, and there was like four girls who seemed like perfectly nice young ladies that were kind of like shy, and they had like that awkward girl dance because they hadn't had a whole lot of interaction with people, and they were just dying for people to ask them to dance. And this one really, I'm not trying to be a jerk, but the guy was really nerdy looking, and he asked this girl to dance, and they had the time of their life. So I'm saying, kids, if you were an awkward boy in high school, which I was myself, I'm still awkward, but I'm not in high school, so I can't ask people to dance anymore. But if you were an awkward young high school kid, go to World Inferno Dance and ask that young girl to dance, and I guarantee you she will say yes, and I guarantee you you'll have a blast.
Why can't you ask people to dance anymore?
Well, because I mean, I'm like 30, and I can't be asking 16-year-old girls to dance.
No, just people on the street.
Oh, on the day? Adam, just for you, next time I'm on the street, I'm just going to ask somebody to dance.
Yeah, right? As you go about your life, just start asking people to dance. Really, I mean, for me, the one that sticks out the most in my head in terms of like dancing at shows and stuff like that was I went to university in Guelph, Ontario, and the Slackers had this thing where they came to our town like once, twice a year for the entire time I was in university, which was awesome. And man, there were shows there where you know, from the time they started to the time, you know, the time the thing ended, you know. No one in that room had to be told to dance. It was just craziness. So, yeah, Slackers. That's what I'm going on.
Well, sounds good. Adam, in the spirit, free speech is one of the fundamental American rights, and I think it's our most important right. And I do feel it's being slightly curtailed these past 10 or 15 years, which I find worrisome. Do Canadians hold the tenets of free speech as sacred as we do in America?
I would say that if you ask the people in Canada, they would say yes, of course, only that they would understand that to be one of the basic tenets of democracy. So of course we're a democratic country, we like our democracy, of course we like free speech. However, I know enough, having worked on Punk News these years, if you ask certain policy wonks and political junkies, in particular if you ask Punk News founder and head honcho Aubin about this, he would say, no, Canadians do not value free speech as much as they do in America, specifically because we have certain hate crimes laws up here in Canada where they probably would not fly in the States because you guys would cry First Amendment on them. But there are certain things like, you know, the truly reprehensible things you would ask anyone that I think are more illegal here or more easily persecuted here because of hate crime legislation that probably would not exist in the U.S. because it would get struck down on First Amendment, you know, basis and stuff like that. So yes, everyone, you know, we like our free speech. We value our free speech. We, for the most part, have our free speech as far as no one's ever curtailed it for me. But I think if you were to, you know, to get the legal scholars involved, they would say, no, the Americans probably have a little bit more than we do.
Well, fair but enough. Go ahead.
But yeah, that's my thing. The one thing though that we don't have, and I think this is the important distinction, is that for you guys, you know, we have comparable founding documents to you. So you guys have, you know, the Constitution that says all these things. You know, we have the Charter of Rights and Freedom, but like the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms was only, I think it was 1982, was it? Yeah, our Constitution was only patriated like 1982. So like we're a 100-year-old country, but a lot of like these kind of foundation legal documents really went into play in 1982, which was when really that the ties between Canada and England were really formally severed. So, you know, a lot of this stuff that used to be under British law went under Canadian law under the books here. So, but I was probably just butchering Canadian history, and I'm sorry if anyone from Canada is listening to that, but I guess that's sort of what happened. So a lot of our documents, a lot of our things are recent enough that there is actually still parts of it that are either contentious up here, or were are seen as being the act of a politician that certain people didn't like on a different end of the political spectrum. So like a lot of like modern day politics plays into that stuff. So we don't treat those things as religious documents to the same degree that you guys do. I mean, we hear it all the time, First Amendment, Second Amendment, you guys are all arguing about these things and like, oh, you know, like that God handed the Constitution down, and you know, are you guys, you know, like to you guys, the Constitution is such a more loaded thing. For ours, you know, all of our comparable legal documents are all still, I guess, still more of an ongoing conversation. They're not seen as so sacrosanct that people can't talk about them in the way that we do. So, so the mood around talking about free speech is entirely different up here, because it's not seen as being like, it's not such a loaded thing.
Well, fair enough. Well, speaking of reprehensible things and free speech, in salute of America's right to free speech and Canada's sort of right to free speech, which is is a little bit more malleable, give or take.
We're gonna take it or leave it, right?
We're going to play one of the filthiest songs I've ever heard. This song is from 1935. It's by a lady called Lucille Bogan, and you're going to think that this is a modern song made to sound old, but I'm telling you, this song was recorded in 1935 before McCarthyism. And this song is so filthy, you won't believe it. I mean, this is a dirty song. This song is called Shave 'Em Dry by Lucille Bogan. I love America. God bless America. God bless Canada. Free speech for everyone. Lucille Bogan playing Shave 'Em Dry.
I got nipples on my titties, big as the end of my thumb. I got something between my legs, I'll make a dead man come. Oh, that. Baby, won't you shave them dry? Ow, Lord, ow. Want you to grind me, baby? Grind me until I cry. Say, I fucked all night and all the night before, baby. And I feel just like I want to fuck some more. Great God, Daddy, grind me, honey. Shave me dry. And then you hear me holler, baby. Want you to change that? I got nipples on my titty, big in my thumb. Daddy said that's the kind of woman you want, and you can make them come. Oh, Daddy, shave me down. And I give you something, baby, where it'll make you cry. I'm gonna turn back my matches and let you oil my springs. I want you to grind me, Daddy, till the bell do ring. Oh, Daddy, want you to shave and dry. Oh, great God, Daddy, if you can't shave him, baby, won't you try? Now, fucking was the thing that would take me to hell, and I'd be fucking in the studio till the clock strike 11. Oh, Daddy. Daddy, shave and dry. I would fuck you, baby. Honey, I'd make you cry. Now your nuts hang down like a damn bell clapper, and your dick stands up like a steeple. Your goddamn asshole stands open like a church door, and the crab walks in like people. Ow! Shit! Get fat from eating corn, and a pig gets fat from sucking. You see this whore fat like I am. Great God, I got fat to suck. My back is made of whalebone, and my cock is made of brass. And my fucking is made for waking me in $2 bed, gotten round to kiss my ass. Oh! Ooh, Daddy, shave him dry.
Well, Well, after listening to that song, you'll probably have to take a shower. I apologize for that, but that's how filthy things got back in 1935. Thanks again for listening to the Punk News Podcast. As always, the opinions expressed on the Punk News Podcast, especially the opinions expressed by Lucille Bogan, are not the opinions of Punk News or do not represent the opinions of Punk News and really represent only the people saying them exclusively. As always, you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org or at Twitter or at Facebook or whatever. Hit us up. We'll get back to you. Thanks for listening, and have a nice barbecue out there or whatever else you're doing.